Welcome to Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest. First, some humor. Here's the funniest confessions from bosses, co-workers, and clueless applicants collected by Reader's Digest. Dumb and dumber on the job in Reader's Digest. First section about dumb employees. Haven't you heard there are no dumb questions in business? From these human resources queries, that truism is clearly not true. There are seven bullets here. Number one, I falsified my resume. Now that I'm working here, can I change it? Number two, can my supervisor require me to have specific working hours? Number three, can I have my salary deferred until next year so I don't have to pay taxes this year? I don't need the money this year. Number four, will you give me a raise if I stop smoking marijuana? Number five, can I wear a swimsuit and towel on casual day? Number six, since my mother and father both died before I came to work at this company, will I be credited for bereavement leave I didn't have to take? And finally, number seven, every day my supervisor tells me to stop chatting and get back to work. Can he do that? Those, by the way, were all collected by workforce.com. Some excuses for missing work are so dumb they almost are inspired. Feel free to borrow these from the future. This comes from jobcluster.com. There are five bullets here. Number one, the employee said that he couldn't come to work because his fortune teller had asked him not to step out of the house or he would suffer a brain hemorrhage. Number two, an employee refused to come to work because his fish was unwell. Number three, the employee said he'd gotten drunk the night before and was now suffering from a hangover. Number four, the employee insisted he'd locked himself in his house by mistake and that the house did not have any windows to crawl out of. Finally, number five here, an employee said his mother made his favorite dish and he ate too much. Next, doctors and nurses in hospitals work long, strenuous hours. Sometimes it shows up in the odd things they accidentally write in the patient charts. Seven of these come from nursebuff.com and nurseslabs.com. Number one, the patient is tearful and crying constantly. She also appears to be depressed. Number two, on the second day, the knee was better, and on the third day, it had completely disappeared. Number three, bleeding began in the rectal area and continued all the way to Los Angeles. Number four, she is numb from the toes down. Number five, the skin was moist and dry. Number six, social history reveals this one-year-old patient does not smoke or drink and is presently unemployed. Finally, number seven, patient has two teenage children but no other abnormalities. And finally, from Reddit, these three, of course, sometimes HR itself is the issue, thanks to some questionable workplace directives. Number one, I'm a teacher, so I have a million stupid rules I have to follow. But the worst one is that my performance evaluation is based on student improvement on a statewide literacy test. I teach wood shop. Number two, at my old job, HR held a meeting to tell us that there was too much swearing on the sales floor. Someone pointed out that swearing is very common in our industry, and that is the way that our customers speak. HR later sent out a memo explaining that swearing should be limited to conversations with clients. And finally, number three, my workplace doesn't let you use the word problems. Instead, we have to say challenges if something is wrong. The next section of Dumb and Dumber on the Job is dedicated to dumb bosses. This first anecdote comes from Inc.com. That's INC.com. After 2 days of heated wrangling, we got one of our vendors to agree to a 35% discount. As we were about to sign the contract, my boss, who had not been a party to the negotiations, walked in and tore it up, saying, "I'm going to teach you purchasing people how to play hardball. That's the way you make it in this world." He turned to the vendor's sales rep and said, "We want a 20% discount. Take it or leave it." The delighted rep immediately agreed. As my boss left, he left to us, "I hope you learned something from that." From pleasefireme.tumblr.com, when corporate came to visit, the CEO complimented me by saying, "You aren't as dumb as HR made you out to be." From cbsnews.com, my boss heard there was an opening for a plant manager in our South American facility. To better prepare himself, he decided to attend Spanish classes on the company's time and at its expense. The only problem, the plant is in Brazil, where they speak Portuguese. From cosmopolitan.com, my boss used to tell me and another coworker he hadn't showered in days and wanted us to make sure clients didn't get close to him at events. CBSNews.com provides this anecdote. I work for a family-owned check-cashing company. One day, I was robbed at gunpoint. The next day, the owners deducted the stolen cash from my paycheck. They said I had willingly complied with the robber's wishes. From Ryan Lost in Taxes, it's a Twitter account. My boss ate all of the breading off of 3 pieces of leftover fried chicken I'd brought to work for lunch. And then he put the naked chicken back into the break room fridge like nothing happened. Inspirational quotes from the men and women who lead us during the work week, collected by Inc.com. There are 5 of them here. Number 1, I know my plan won't work, but don't disagree with me in front of the others. Number 2, if you are on schedule, then your plan was not aggressive enough. If you are behind schedule, you must be goofing off. Number 3, what this department lacks is leadership. Number 4, bonuses in my department are awarded to team players who have demonstrated an appreciation for my leadership. And finally, number 5, I tried to email you to tell you that my email wasn't working, but my email wasn't working. And finally, from the Twitter account Dabberhasher, I got a citation in my employee file because I told my boss that Bob Marley did not sing Red Red Wine. And now to dumb customers. This first anecdote comes from clientsfromhell.net. Found this gem of an email in the inbox today. Client: Hello, my fiancé and I are looking for a wedding photographer, but are having some issues with the contracts we are coming across. We want a clause that guarantees us a refund should we ever get divorced, since we would not need the photos in that situation. Please let me know if this is something you have in your contract or would be willing to add. Thank you. From pleasefireme.tumblr.com, a customer came to the counter and wanted to buy a Big Mac. When I told her we didn't have those, she asked for a Whopper instead. I told her we didn't have those either, and she got mad at me and walked away. I work at KFC. From clientsfromhell.net, 3 designers share their oddest client requests. Number 1, I want you to build me an app store, like the Apple App Store, but better. Number 2, the roast duck on the menu looks kind of dull. Can you make it look more alive and happy? And number 3, can you please move the image up a tad and down a hair? The next collection, when you're a cop, Joe and Jane Public are your clients. And on occasion, you can expect these bizarre 911 calls such as these. And this comes from PoliceOne.com, HuffingtonPost.com, and MercuryNews.com. Number 1, a woman requested to talk with a police officer because her housekeeper wasn't putting her towels away properly. Number 2, police receive a report of a newborn infant found in a trash can. Upon investigation, officers discover it was only a burrito. Number 3, during a disturbance call, a man gave an officer a false name and was arrested after he was found to have warrants for both names. Number 4, a woman whose finger got stuck in a drain was reported to be conscious and breathing. And finally, number 5, suspicious people were reportedly doing something with flashlights. A deputy checked and found the people were not suspicious, but merely Canadian. from NBCMiami.com. It's come to this. A Florida gas station owner has had to place a sign in her store asking customers not to warm their urine in the microwave. Parul Patel's Jacksonville gas station convenience store is just a few blocks away from two drug testing services. Why the urine has to be delivered warm, we can only guess. But when Patel confronted one woman, she indignantly demanded to see a sign that bans nuking urine in her store. Hence the sign. From pleasefireme.tumblr.com again, I work at a museum, and a woman asked me if mummies were older than dinosaurs. And from kcrg.com, we actually get this question on a pretty regular basis, says an official with Iowa's Department of Transportation. The source of confusion, the deer crossing signs that are posted along the road. And the question, why don't you put these signs where it's safer for the deer to cross? The next section is called And Just Plain Dumb. BusinessInsider.com first. I showed up wearing two different colored shoes to make a major presentation to an audience of 230 people. From Reddit.com, this guy came into my Walmart back room, put on a vest, picked up the biggest TV, and put it on a cart, dropped it, and then asked me to help him lift it. The guy thanked me and left with his brand new TV that I'd helped him steal. From Quickbase.com, at the end of a phone call, I told my boss I loved him. I caught myself, but started rambling, "Oh my God, I didn't mean that. I absolutely don't love you. No, I mean, I like working for you, and I know you're married and I'm married, but I'm not flirting, so please don't report me to HR. At some point, he just hung up. From the Twitter account Entropy72, I once sent a company-wide virus warning by forwarding an email so people could see what it looked like should they receive one and forgetting to remove the infected attachment. From CoburgBanks.co.uk, on my first day of work, I accidentally called my boss Daddy. From TheStir.CafeMom.com, when I was a teenager, I applied for a job at a hospital gift shop and was so pumped when I got the call that they wanted me. When I showed up for my first shift, the manager gave me the weirdest look, then told me to wait while she called someone. Turns out that they interviewed two girls named Jessica and meant to hire the other one. They offered me a candy bar, quote-unquote, for my trouble. I'm still bitter. From the section here, marked Dumb Applicants, looking for a job? Make sure your resume is up to snuff. A lot of job seekers don't, and we've pulled together some actual blunders to prove it. These come from RobertHalf.com, Almagretta.com, CoburgBanks.co.uk, and Archive.fortune.com. Objective, to secure a position as a front office. Here's from the section Employment History. Last job, drove a tow truck. That's T-O-E. Before that, worked in the dessert. And before that, oversaw all new corporate acquisitions. Responsibilities included recruiting, interviewing, and executing final candidates. And before that one, watered, groomed, and fed the family dog for years. Under skills, perfectionist with a keen eye for details. And that's the letter I. Being bilingual in three languages. And natural born larder. References. Claire. Compensation. Current salary, $36,000. Salary desired, $223,000. Interests. I enjoy cooking Chinese and Italians. My three biggest hobbies are cars, racquetball, golf, and reading. I like donuts, cupcakes, chocolate, and ice cream. Together. Honestly, I like doing nothing. Finally, under education, this grand typo, graduated in 2911. There are three pictures that came with this, by the way. One of them, above a toilet, says, please check if you flushed. Thank you. And there are check marks all over the sign. Another one, of a coffee maker. Coffee maker is not hot. Someone put a post-it on there. Such a great personality, though. And a suggestion box in which the suggestions are fed into a shredder. Next from Reader's Digest, drama in real life. On a run in the Rocky Mountains, the author's dog, Merle, fell 800 feet, injured beyond hope. But he wasn't done yet. Here's The Dog That Came Back from the Dead by Eric Wagenknecht with Tess Strokes from OutsideOnline.com. We charge up the final ascent of the 13,041-foot Grand Traverse Peak about 7 miles east of Vail, Colorado. My new running partner, Merle, a one-year-old blue Australian Shepherd, seemed unfazed by the previous 8 miles we'd covered. I also felt strong, energized by the clear Rocky Mountain air and endless blue sky. It was Father's Day 2017, and I was set to return home to my 4-year-old son, Axel, my 9-year-old daughter, Lily, and my wife, Susan, by noon. As I reached the summit, I heard a short yelp, but assumed Merle would be seconds behind me, as he had been all morning. I snapped a photo of the view for my family, called out to the dog, then tucked my phone in my pack and headed back down the trail. Merle was nowhere to be seen. "Merle! Merle!" I called. "Where are you?" I felt a tickle of panic in my throat as I threaded my way down the ridge, still seeing no signs of him. But he was athletic and young and invincible. He must be fine, I reasoned. Then, several hundred feet farther down, I saw his paw prints on a 5-foot strip of snow at the top of a steep chute. I followed them cautiously until they disappeared entirely off the edge. About 800 feet below, the chute ended abruptly in a boulder field and a massive cliff. Below that, I could see a wide, empty, snow-covered basin. There was no sign of Merle in the rock field or the basin. I could still hear that last yelp in my mind, and now I realized what it had signaled. Merle was gone. Merle and I had started the day at 4 a.m. at our home in Eagle, Colorado. I'd stacked my running clothes next to the bed the night before and filled my pack with water bottles, trail food, and a can of sardines, my go-to for big days in the mountains. It would be my first long run in the Gore Range this summer and my first big adventure with Merle. We'd bought the 40-pound blue and brown-eyed Aussie Shepherd 6 months earlier from a breeder in Durango. Merle quickly proved himself to be a phenomenal running partner. He could easily bang out 15 miles. That morning, we drove 36 miles from our house to the Deluge Lake Trailhood in East Vail. I'd grown up in Illinois, but as a kid, made frequent trips to Vail, where my late father had a house. I'd hiked this trail every year since I was 7. My dad, a mountaineer and ultra runner, would take me and my younger sister up the 8 miles to Deluge Lake, training as he called it, for our annual summit of the Mount of the Holy Cross, the peak where I would spread his ashes in the year 2002. I hadn't thought twice about taking Merle up Grand Traverse. In fact, I'd expected him to beat me to the summit, which is why, even as I stood above the steep chute, I still thought, it's going to be okay. I knew the summit was the only spot on the trail where I would get cell service, so I called Susan, panicked. "Merle fell. I don't know what happened," I told her. "I'm going for him. It's okay. I'm okay." Then I saw something running in the basin below me. "There he is! Oh my God, I'm okay, I need to go!" "Okay, be safe," was all Susan had time to say before I hung up and ran down the ridge. Merle was sprinting downhill, away from me. I couldn't follow his nearly vertical route without technical climbing gear, so I needed to find a safer way down. After nearly an hour, I had made it to the basin, and I saw Merle standing on a large rock outcropping. Relief washed over me. "Merle, come here, buddy. Good dog. I'm so sorry," I called. But he ran away. I didn't blame him. I'd taken him on a selfish pursuit to a selfish place. I'd pushed him too far. I followed Merle up the basin. Soon, I was close enough to see that he looked oddly swollen. He was covered with lacerations, and his gait was hobbled and stiff. When I got within a few feet of him, he dived into a crack at the edge on a field of rocks. I grabbed his back legs for a moment, but he squirmed away, deep into a subterranean pocket within the boulders. I moved rocks and snow away from the crack's entrance until two backyard grill-sized boulders slid together, clamping my ring finger between them. I yanked out my hand and saw the nail was smashed and spurting blood. I threw on a glove from my pack to contain the flow, then kept digging. A few months later, I'd cleared enough snow to stick my head in the crack. I peered down into the darkness. I could hear the jingle of Merle's collar, but I couldn't see him. I yelled, alternating between angry and nearly hysterical, and calm and coaxing. No response. I decided to give him space. Maybe he was okay, and my panic was freaking him out. I opened the can of sardines and left them as a lure at the mouth of the cave. While I waited, I went to the scene of the fall. Above, I saw the path Merle had taken. He'd slid some 700 feet down the upper snowfield, fallen off a 40-foot cliff, then rolled down another 100-foot cliff to the lower snowfield where I now stood. How did he walk away from this? I thought. I returned to the crack, leaned in, and called his name again. Inside, it smelled wet. After a decade of archery hunting, I knew the scent. It smelled like death. I spent another hour crouched outside the cave until the jingle of the collar and Merle's deep breathing stopped. It was late afternoon, and I worried about losing daylight. I was on the wrong side of a big mountain, many miles from home, and not prepared to spend the night outside. I packed up, traversed the basin, descended a slushy snowfield, then found my way to the base of the chute I'd come down. I climbed the melting snowpack as quickly as I could, reusing my kicked steps from the descent. When I got reception, I phoned Susan. "I'm okay, Suze, but I'm walking down alone." "Is he dead?" "Yeah." Then I ran away, back down the trail. I didn't know that Lily and Axel had heard me through our car's Bluetooth system. After I hung up, they burst into tears. I've always owned dogs. They accompanied me into the mountains where, bounding off-leash, they seemed protected by an invincible athleticism. Merle was bred for the trail. I had assumed the rugged Aussie would take to the high alpine trail intuitively. But the reality is that almost no one thinks about training their dogs for the mountains. In potentially deadly terrain, it's critical that humans help dogs understand their limits, says Amber Kwan, who runs Summit Dog Training in Fort Collins, Colorado. She helps owners and dogs prepare for outdoor adventures through relationship building and body conditioning classes. Dogs can't talk to us, but they have other ways of communicating that we need to pay attention to. It's up to us to learn their idiosyncrasies. Of course, it's difficult to tune into a dog's subtle behavior changes when you're listening to a podcast or chatting with your climbing partner. It's as simple as putting your phone down and being present in the moment, Kwan says. That communication leads to trust, which is another part of taking a dog into the mountains. You have to trust your dog to make good decisions by giving her a safe amount of freedom and not always interrupting her natural behaviors, Kwan says. We want owners to help their dogs, but not micromanage them. The bottom line, she notes, is if a trip will be more stressful with your dog, leave him or her at home. I knew Susan questioned whether I'd done enough to keep Merle safe. My possible carelessness gnawed at me, too, so I called our longtime vet and friend, Charlie Manier, owner of Vale Valley Animal Hospital, to try to get some closure. He assured me I had done everything I could to save Merle. He crawled into that cave to secure shelter, which is typical for a dog in distress who is on the verge of dying. They hide and hunker down, he said. 3 weeks later, on July 8, a real estate agent named Dana Dennis Gumber was preparing a listing in East Vale, less than a mile from the Deluge Lake trailhead where Merle and my journey had started off. she noticed a ragged-looking dog near the property's deck and assumed he belonged to the landscapers working on the complex. But when she returned to the house 2 hours later, the crew had left and the dog was curled by the front door. Gumber had noticed him limping earlier, and now that she saw that he was filthy, weak, and skeletally thin, she ushered the dog into her car, then took him to her Eagle Vale home for food and water. Miraculously, Gumber found that dog still had a collar. That afternoon, she left a voicemail on my cell. "I have Merle. Please call me." I'd left town a few days earlier for a work trip to Austria. I got the call and FaceTimed Susan back home immediately, where it wasn't yet dawn. Neither of us knew what the message meant. Susan assumed it was a sick prank, but she agreed to call the woman back that morning. A few hours later, we had an answer. "Merle was alive," Susan said. "I'm getting him this afternoon." When she got to Gumber's house, she collapsed to the floor as soon as she saw Merle, gently stroking his battered body. He seemed to recognize her, though his wandering eyes made her think he'd suffered some brain damage. Susan drove him to Vail Valley Animal Hospital, where emergency veterinarian Rebecca Hall found that Merle had 2 detached retinas, a punctured lung, facial lacerations, and sores on his hind legs. He had lost about 12 pounds, almost a third of his weight. His stool showed that he'd survived on pine needles and berries. He was tattered, but remarkably, he didn't need stitches, and none of his bones were broken. Dr. Hall was amazed that Merle had walked away from falling so far. He had hunkered down in a cave, likely gone into a coma, then woken up and, seriously injured, covered 20 miles in 20 days to return home. "You don't hear a lot of stories about dogs surviving in the wilderness," Quan says, "but herding breeds are driven and tough. His return was most likely testament to his positive association with home. These dogs are incredibly bonded to their owners." Quan says Merle probably followed human spells on the trail to get back to civilization. "We can't wrap our brains around how easy it is for a dog to follow a scent or hear traffic miles away," she says. Plus, after a week in the wilderness, Merle's senses had likely sharpened. "I guess it was this combination, plus intuition and some luck, that got him home," she says. Over the next week, while I was still away, Merle recovered beautifully. His wandering eyes straightened, he gained weight, and his gait returned to normal. Axel and Lily, who now fully believe in miracles, spent every moment with their best friend. When I got home just after midnight one day later that month, I walked through the front door, anxious to see Merle. Would he run from me again? I entered our living room, then kneeled down and called him to me. He gave a quick bark before lowering his ears, tucking in his tail, and wiggling onto my lap. He clawed my chest like he wanted to climb on top of my shoulders and kissed my face. And finally, let's conclude this Reader's Digest edition with some Life in These United States anecdotes. Here are 3 from MyLifeIsAverage.com. Number 1. "Today, I met a girl named Unique," I said. "She has an identical twin sister." No one thought that was funny. Number 2. "Today in Latin, my teacher was trying to figure out how many days were in July. I said 31. He asked whether I knew it from a rhyme or something. I said yes. The real reason I know it is that Harry Potter's birthday is July 31st. And finally, number 3, "Today, I was at the doctor's office. Because I'm a teenager, I was required to take a survey about drugs, alcohol, and sex. It asked whether I was in a gang. I wrote, quote-unquote, marching band." Thank you for listening to today's Reader's Digest. If you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.